This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Indianapolis ranks 14th in eviction rates among large U.S. cities, according to national data. Fort Wayne ranks 13th, South Bend 18th. That means among the top 20 cities across the U.S. with high eviction rates, Indiana holds three of those slots. Why are those numbers so high in Indiana cities? Have you or someone you know faced eviction? How has that affected your life since then? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Here to help explain the situation is Michael Hurst, senior attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Michael, thanks for your time today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
The national data is striking. And if we zoom in further, 40% of Indiana evictions occurred here in Marion County alone. It's not much of a stretch to call the eviction issues of Marion County an epidemic. And you've been on the ground working with those affected in Marion County for some time. Would you characterize the issue as an epidemic?
Oh, I would. And the numbers that you cited relate to the eviction rates, how many evictions per 100 households. The number that's really striking for me is that by the same report, Indianapolis ranks second in the nation with the most evictions, only behind New York City. Indianapolis had in 2016 11,570 evictions, and the only major metropolitan area that had more evictions than Indianapolis was New York City.
Wow.
So we do have I would say an epidemic.
We hear these staggering statistics, and that's one we hadn't run across. But I'm wondering if you can help us understand the people and the families behind them, the actual people that are affected. We don't often hear about those balancing on the brink of eviction, just being a paycheck away from panic.
Right. And that's my typical client. My typical client is going to be African-American female, single mom with two or more children, and usually has lost her income as a result of losing a job or because she's become disabled or because she had a chronic illness. I had one client who had a stroke and was in the hospital when they fell behind on rent and were subject to an eviction. But that's the typical client. That's the typical client in a failure to pay case. I think a lot of people expect tenants in eviction actions to be villains in some way, shape, or form. And in 10 months of doing this particular project I'm working on for legal services, you know, we anticipated we'd have about 110 referrals over the course of a year. And in 10 months, we've had 225 up to today. Most of those clients are non-payment of rent cases, Matt, and most of those, almost all of those non-payment of rent cases are as a result of somebody unexpectedly losing income.
And what are the types of factors or decisions that are made? And sometimes these are made in sort of a panic situation that typically sort of push people over the brink and into an eviction risk.
Well,
obviously, income disparity and things like that.
I'll give you a perfect example, and it repeats itself over and over again. Oftentimes, the tenant in a landlord-tenant situation is responsible for paying utilities. And I had one client very recently and multiple clients over 11 months who made the decision to pay the high utility bill that they had that left them without enough money to make their rent payments. So they paid the utility bill so that they could avoid losing power that would heat their homes or air condition their homes. And then they were unable to make the rent payment on time as a result of making that very difficult decision. We see that kind of decision repeating itself a lot. I've got limited income. Maybe I'm disabled. I'm getting Social Security disability income. It's limited. I have medications to purchase. I have to buy school clothes for my kids. I have transportation issues. I mean, all of us, I think, have to make those kinds of balancing decisions. But most of us are blessed with the ability to make those decisions without putting ourselves at risk of becoming homeless.
I can't imagine choosing between lights and rent, two things you need to pay. Last October, Indiana Legal Services, who you're with, launched the Eviction Avoidance Project. How did this program get started?
Okay. So, but largely as a result of the statistics you've been citing in 2016, these stats came to light. The Princeton Eviction Lab laid it all out. And as a response to that, What we did at Legal Services, in conjunction with lawyers from Neighborhood Christian Legal Center and a number of others who were doing this work, is we put together a project that would put an attorney in small claims court here in Indianapolis, which is where all the evictions happen, put an attorney with the client, with the tenant in those cases. Generally, we would provide, or Legal Services would provide, advice to people who were going to experience eviction as a result of nonpayment of rent. But this idea was to put an attorney in court to tell their story. Basically, and this, I think, is the villainy in the whole thing, is the process, because there's so many cases, the process becomes very transactional. So a landlord or a landlord's counsel will come in, and they'll come in with a stack of files, and it's a pretty straightforward process. Tenant who may or may not show up. If they show up, are you behind in rent? Yes is the answer. Possession goes to the landlord. 5 days later, there's a writ of eviction, and the tenant can be forced out if they're not already out. This project puts an attorney in between that process, slows it down, and allows the attorney and the tenant to negotiate a soft landing. Basically, it's a homeless prevention project, Matt, first and foremost. The idea is to keep an eviction off a tenant's record, because evictions on a record cause that tenant to fall further down the ladder, might make it harder for them to rent a place moving forward. But also because we work specifically with clients who have some vulnerability, mental illness, criminal background, something like that. If they're evicted, it's going to be harder for them to find housing.
What I'm hearing, as what I'm assuming as I hear this is really the only way that someone in this situation could be represented by an attorney. It's not like they can afford it.
No, and again, we call it a right to counsel model, basically. So I'll be the attorney in these cases. Again, we're only piloting this right now in Marion County, but I'm going to review the lease. I'm going to look at the notices. I'm going to evaluate the case to see if there are any defenses that would be available to the tenant's situation, whether it's nonpayment of rent or keeping a pet, an unauthorized pet, or whatever it might be. I'm going to look for those defenses. But in 8 out of 10 cases, Matt, what I'm actually going to be doing is working with the landlord or the landlord's attorney to negotiate a payment schedule to allow my client to get caught up if they can, or to negotiate enough time, not 5 days, but enough time for that client to find other housing and vacate voluntarily without an eviction on their record so that they have a soft landing. And that's really what this project is all about, is helping people find a soft landing and avoid an eviction because they fell behind in their rent or because there was some other violation of the lease, and to get them connected with financial assistance. We work with a lot of community partners. Most of my cases come from direct referrals from community partners like Aspire Mental Health or Step Up Incorporated, who works with folks on reentry or with chronic illness. But basically to connect them with those community partners if they're not connected, or to supplement with legal services what those community partners are already doing with our clients.
When you're representing these people, what are effective arguments to giving them a soft landing or keeping them in their homes? What comes to mind is the human element.
Oh, it is. Telling their story is huge. I have to tell you this. One of the cases that I had not too long ago involved a man who had been homeless for 40 years. I said 40, 4-0.
Wow.
40 years. And he was, and everybody can agree, I think, that housing somebody who's experiencing homelessness is a good goal. So he worked with a community partner who was able to get him into housing. But because he'd been homeless for so long, he had a difficult time adjusting to living in a multi-unit housing situation. And so he committed some violations of his lease. There really isn't a defense when you've got a situation like that, where you've got somebody who admittedly is committing these violations, but the outcome of evicting that individual without there being a soft landing is just going to put him right back out on the street. And so in that case, we worked with the landlord, who was very accommodating. We worked with the court. We were able to keep him housed for another 60 days while that community partner was able to find him housing that he could vacate from his place and move into. He was able to leave without an eviction. Now, for him, it might not have mattered so much to have an eviction on his record after 40 years of homelessness. But again, I've got dozens and dozens of clients who are in a similar situation because of non-payment. They need somebody to tell their story so that the judge and the landlord can make a decision that is less transactional. Again, I really have had a hard time finding any villains in this process. Sure, they exist, but the villainy, I think, is the numbers and the transactional nature of this process. The courts and the landlord's attorneys don't have the kind of time to unpack what a tenant wants to unpack. An attorney helping the tenant is going to be able to do that efficiently.
Yeah, the antagonist is a little more abstract, I guess.
Yeah.
And how does someone like that, or a typical evictee, if there is such a thing, find out about you and your services?
So again, most of my referrals for this eviction avoidance project come from community partners. So these are going to be clients who are already working on their vulnerability, whatever it might be, and they're threatened with eviction or subject to eviction, so they're referred to me by the community partners, and those partners know about us. But we also get cases that come through our general intake process. Somebody calls legal services, pardon me, tells their story to legal services, and then if legal services believes it fits the criteria for the eviction avoidance project, that case is referred to me. And if I'm able to take it on, I'll take it on. If not, then it gets referred to another attorney in our office for at the very least advice.
This might be an uncomfortable question for you, but how on earth do you get paid for this sort of thing? Where does funding come from?
You know, I'm really glad you asked that question because oftentimes I talk so much about the tenants that I fail to mention that we wouldn't be able to do this project at all because we just didn't have capacity if it weren't for funding. So this project started with seed money from the Indianapolis Bar Foundation. They gave us $50,000, one-time grant to get this going. That was supplemented by the Central Indiana Community Foundation and by the Indianapolis Neighborhood Housing Partnership. That covered our first year.
Up next, we'll find out what research tells us about evictions from LeVar Edmonds of Princeton's Eviction Lab on what the records of 83 million evictions across the country are telling researchers. We'll also be joined by Brianka Merritt from IU on how Indiana fits in. And we'll hang on to you, Michael, if you don't mind staying.
Not at all.
And, of course, as always, your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking about evictions and how three Indiana cities, Fort Wayne, South Bend, and Indianapolis, have made the list of the top 20 cities for eviction rates in the U.S. If you've ever experienced the eviction process, we want to hear from you, whether you've been evicted or if you're a landlord and you were forced to evict someone. What was it like? We want to hear from you. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll get your comments in front of our panel. Right now, we're joined by Brianka Merritt, director of IU's Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy. Good afternoon, Brianka.
Hello.
And we're also joined via Skype by LeVar Edmonds, senior research specialist at the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Brianka Merritt, some of your work is on finding out what causes evictions. That seems, from the outside, like a really complicated thing to measure. How do you approach this as a researcher?
Well, I think it's important to note that it's really difficult to get at causality, like you're saying. But we do know that there are several things that are associated with it and that complicate the process a little more. So we also worked with a lot of tenants, people who'd been evicted, landlords, talking with them and understanding more of the context of what's happening locally in addition to looking at and analyzing data.
As we've kind of dug into this, we've found out that the data is recent and somewhat incomplete. Is there good data on evictions in Marion County and all around Indiana?
Well, fortunately, we have someone on the call who's going to who can represent the Eviction Lab. I think that is by far the best source that we've had, and it was really a lightning in a bottle opportunity for a lot of people around the country looking at eviction. Other than that, it gets a little more complicated,
I would imagine. Do you have a sense, though, for how much research has been done on this before? Or is this a fairly recent thing to really look at eviction specifically?
I think Matthew Desmond's work really highlighted a lot of eviction-related issues from a national perspective that really engaged a lot of organizations in the conversation. Folks like Michael have been doing this work for a long time. But I think housing affordability has become an issue, regardless of whether people are renting or owning. And so when you couple that with evictions in the conversation, it makes sense that that's kind of come to the forefront as well.
Why do you think more research hasn't been done? Was this just too difficult a topic, or was it just something that people hadn't thought about yet?
You know, from a research perspective, I think to do it well, like I said, you brought up the issue of, do we have good data available? The question is, not really. It takes a lot of work to get good information. It relies on our court system to report evictions accurately. As one of our other panelists can attest, when you are reporting that information, there are lots of people who their evictions are not on anybody's record. So they're informal evictions that aren't even being captured. So a lot of what we're presenting is often an underestimate. So we really don't have this perfect calculation, but it does give us a good idea.
LeVar Edmonds, you work at the Eviction Lab, which looks at all of this on a national scale. Can you talk about how that got started and what data you're working with?
Sure. So it very much is piggybacking, as you mentioned, off of the previous work that Matt Desmond had done based in Milwaukee. And he had this vision to essentially expand upon that, you know, and take it nationally up until we published our database online about 18 months ago. There wasn't a national database of evictions. So we didn't have a sense nationally of how many people are being evicted across the country year to year. And so we've been working over the last little over 2 years now to compile and publish this database on evictions that is focused specifically on what we call formal evictions. So evictions that were carried out through some sort of court proceeding. And so we've pulled through a variety of sources our court records around over 80 million court records for 17 years, 2000 to 2016. And so we've spent the better part of 2 years cleaning, geocoding, analyzing these numbers to try to provide a fuller picture of what's happening with evictions nationally.
I can imagine that focusing specifically on evictions can perhaps yield some interesting conclusions that you wouldn't otherwise get if you were just looking at poverty and evictions as an aside.
Yeah, definitely. And that's part of, I think, the interesting part of this story and part of what, you know, Matt sort of saw in Milwaukee and what we're continuing to unpack nationally is the relationship between poverty and eviction. That, yes, a huge part of what's driving eviction is poverty or rather low-income households and inability to access affordable housing. But there's also that other element of the story where eviction is sort of pushing people further into poverty. That, you know, I was on a panel with someone last year in Virginia who was talking about how the first eviction that her family experienced was because her mom had loaned her cousin money to prevent her from having an eviction. And then when time came, then she herself didn't have enough money to pay the rent, and so the eviction for her. And so it's this sort of revolving door of, yes, there's a financial component of poverty that is driving evictions, but also we need to pay attention to the ways in which eviction can push people further into financial distress.
I think that's been the most interesting thing that I've found out in sort of looking into this for this show is the conclusion that the Eviction Lab has come to, that evictions are a cause of poverty and not just a condition.
So that's tough. Of course, establishing anything with causality is a little tricky, and it's hard to say for sure that that is the case. I would say that when we're looking across the country and doing even just correlational stuff, and you can, anyone listening can do this as an exercise on our website, when you overlay, say, eviction rates or even eviction filing rates and poverty, you'll see that, yes, there is some correlation, but it's not always necessarily the case that low poverty areas are going to have low eviction rates and high poverty areas are going to have high eviction rates. When you look at eviction in Virginia, for instance, you look at Norfolk, Virginia, where I'm originally from, and Chesapeake, Virginia, a neighboring city, you see these astronomically high eviction rates, some of the highest eviction rates in the country. But when you look at it, you know, Chesapeake has half the eviction rate of Norfolk. Chesapeake is, by most conventional measures, a fairly wealthy city. And so you would expect that it would have a much lower eviction rate in Norfolk. And no, the reality is it isn't. It's fairly similar. And so you what we're doing now is starting to unpack these questions, even if we can't establish causality, is to call into question, okay, there's something more than just there's poverty causing eviction. Is there eviction leading to poverty? Are there other factors at play? These are all questions that we have to grapple with if we're going to try to figure out the best ways to try to combat eviction.
Brianka, your center released a report this year on eviction trends in Marion County using data from 2010 to 2016. What was interesting about that you found?
I would definitely echo our panelists in saying that we found similar trends, that it wasn't poverty, it wasn't rent burdens, things that we think about with affordability that were really associated with evictions. It was all these other factors like crime and race that aren't necessarily that have been discussed as being related to eviction, but it wasn't the things that we automatically trigger and think of, oh, well, people just can't afford their rent. That wasn't it either locally. I think another important thing to note is that we saw differences across townships. What makes Marion County unique is that we have a township-based eviction system. So that means instead of having an entire county, we have 9 different areas who are facilitating the eviction process. And so when you look across those townships, we found different eviction rates and trends in those rates, depending on where people live.
Well, and it looks like Marion County's eviction filing rates were way higher than the national rate, which we've talked about. Does that mean that a lot more people here try unsuccessfully to get people evicted, or does that mean something else?
Well, it's a little more complicated, and I'll let the eviction lab talk a little bit more about how that's measured. But essentially, once an eviction filing represents the number of so if you have one person living in a house and that person gets evicted, that counts as one eviction. Mm. If there are multiple evictions in a household, you can file those. So we might see like 5 filings for one address, but it would still only register as one eviction. So again, when we think about kind of how that's represented in the data, there could be the case there are more evictions. And so the filings, I think, give us a good idea of kind of who's at least trying to go through the system. We just don't know exactly how that ends up necessarily.
LeVar, as a researcher, how difficult is that to sort of unpack all of that and make sure that you're getting the right numbers?
Pretty hard. We are a team of, 6 to 8, I'm losing count at this point, full-time researchers, not including Matt, who have been working on these data for, 2 years. And we're still, even before this call, I'm still refining things across the country. So much of, I think, the difficulty does come from the fact that evictions and how evictions courts handle, or how civil courts, housing courts, whatever you want to call them, are handling evictions from state to state, sometimes county to county or city to city, varies so much that it's definitely not as easy as opening an Excel spreadsheet and seeing very clean data, seeing all the filings that happened in 2016 and just summing them up. It takes a lot of painstaking, I'll say, analysis to make sure that these data are clean and rarely, fairly verified across other data sources. It's a lot to unpack for sure.
Studying this seems like such a frontier. Brianka, what have researchers found about how much homelessness is caused by evictions?
Oh, it's one of the biggest predictors of homelessness. Again, thinking about how evictions are related to poverty and that not necessarily causal, but that definite association with it. We think about evictions, the cycle that creates, the difficulty in, your credit score, being able to find another place, saving up money to pay a first month's rent. It definitely creates that cycle. And of course, if you can't afford to do those things, you find yourselves, especially with families who are more likely to be evicted, looking for places like shelters, like couch surfing with friends and family because they can't afford another place to rent.
I'm sure that this is something that people who it happens to have a hard time talking about. And we've talked about the challenges in getting this data. Is it easy to track what happens to people after they're evicted?
No.
No.
I think
short answer.
Yeah, echoing LeVar's point about how complicated that court data can be, looking even at Marion County's court data, which was difficult to obtain, they're barely entering information about things like race or gender that would really give us some robust information about who those folks are, much less being able to track them after they leave. So that requires a lot of, to your point, following up with people who've experienced an eviction and getting kind of their firsthand story of what's happened.
Is there such a thing as a typical example of what happens to people after they're evicted? Or does it run a spectrum?
I think it runs the spectrum, but I do think that frequently, I think, depending on how that eviction takes place, minimally, there is a level of psychological distress and frustration. So thinking about mental health effects as well. When we think about the fact that a lot of families tend to get evicted, the effects that mobility has on children, and the fact that just that initial idea that you don't have a place to stay is very jarring, and trying to scramble and figure out what you're going to do next, I think it's pretty typical. I think Michael probably has more firsthand knowledge, but from our work, I think there's just generally a feeling of, well, got to get up, got to find another place to go. And it just, depending on what that looked like, was based on their ability to either find someone who was nice enough to let them in and get the ability to save up some funds for something else.
LeVar, Brianka has been talking about some of the trends she's seen here. What trends are you seeing across the country or in certain areas that are of interest?
Sure. So a lot, I'll say. Yeah. So one of the recurring ones, and I guess a big one from our research, is highlighting the prevalence of serial evictions. And so what we're seeing is fairly common across the country are these instances where the landlord will file multiple times on the same tenant in the same household. And using the courts less so as an eviction mechanism, and we know this because we will see, you know, the same landlord and same tenant in the same address appear multiple times, and some oftentimes have an eviction judgment for each of those cases. But clearly the tenant isn't, you know, leaving the property. It's rather the landlords are using the courts as more of a debt collection mechanism. And so we are seeing, you know, this is not just an issue in certain parts of the country. It's, of course, just like evictions and eviction filings in general. It is particularly prevalent, I'd say, in the southeastern United States and in the mid-Atlantic region. But, you know, looking in the research that we're working on now, looking at the sample, we see almost half of cases in our sample, eviction cases, were in some way affiliated with serial cases. So we're seeing that, you know, the number of filings across the country is massive. You know, if you were to try to quantify or contextualize, I'll say, evictions and eviction filings, if you looked at the number of evictions, eviction filings every year, we're seeing more eviction filings than we saw every year at the height of the foreclosure crisis. Foreclosures, you know, in 2007, 2010 time period.
Are you talking about money judgments, or is this something else?
Yeah, we're seeing eviction judgments in court records. Yes,
and this is a means for debt collection.
Well, sir, so yeah, make sure I'm not you know, intertwining two different stories.
Sure.
So for serial evictions, yes, we're talking about filings, and oftentimes landlords will get an eviction judgment, but they aren't necessarily evicting the tenant. They're just sort of using it as sort of leverage to try to incentivize. Or you know, suss out some sort of back rent for tenants, but there's a problem with that. So many problems with that. One of which is one that's overburdening the courts. That already this process is very much looking across the country. We're seeing it is very transactional. That, you know, the courts are overburdened already, and it's not so much, you know, hearing each individual case and trying to deal with evictions or, you know, anyone's specific situation. It's more just sort of like a conveyor belt, that there are court systems around the country that sort of only work because of how many tenants are defaulting or not appearing in court. That if everyone was appearing in court based off all these filings, we wouldn't have, you know, the courts would sort of implode. And so serial evictions sort of compound that issue. We're seeing that, you know, multiple filings, because then you're tacking on then the back rent, you're tacking on attorney costs, you can sometimes tack on court costs and filing fees. We're seeing that serial evictions on average can, or, you know, a serial case on average is increasing the household income or house home, you know, debt, I'll say, by like 20%. And so having this situation where landlords are repeatedly filing on the same tenants, more or less unnecessarily, is compounding the issue.
We only have about a minute left. Brianka, what about the role that judges play in all of this?
Yeah, I would say for sure Marion County, because we have a township-based eviction system, there's a lot of discretion there. And so they have the opportunity to prevent some of those serial evictions, because they can actually say, hey, you guys need to work this out. Because what we also found is that to his point, landlords are bringing tenants to court when really they're just trying to get their attention to pay rent or get their attention to do something else. And so by being able to mediate that and work it out, some judges were really emphasizing the opportunity to work out the situation versus actually putting it on someone's record. So there's an opportunity to not even allow that eviction to touch someone's record. It allows them to have more opportunity to not let it hit their credit score and have better effects potentially long term.
We're talking about evictions, how they happen, why they happen, and the impact they have on people in society. We've been joined by Brianka Merritt, director of IU's Center for Research on Inclusion and Social Policy. Thanks for your time today, Brianka.
Thank you.
And LeVar Edmonds, senior research specialist with the Eviction Lab at Princeton University. Thank you, LeVar.
Thank you very much.
Attorney Michael Hurst is still with us from Indiana Legal Services. And next, we'll be joined by the Policy Director for Prosperity Indiana, Kathleen Lara. We're also taking your questions and comments on social media. We especially want to hear from you if you or someone you know has had personal experience with evictions, whether you're a landlord or a tenant. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our guests, I want to let you know about a show we did on Tuesday on mental health in Indiana schools. There was some great insight from some important guests and a powerful moment when we heard from a parent about how his son's life was saved by an in-school mental health program. You can hear that and all past shows at WFYI.org/all in. Again, WFYI.org/all in. Back now to our discussion on evictions. We still have attorney Michael Hurst from Indiana Legal Services with us, and we're joined now by Kathleen Lara. She is the policy director for Prosperity Indiana, an advocacy group that focuses on economic and social equity. Kathleen, thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To start out, Kathleen, can you describe what Prosperity Indiana does and who you work with when you advocate on this issue?
So we're a network of nearly 200 organizations statewide, focused pretty exclusively on ensuring people have access to safe, affordable housing, particularly for low-wealth households, and ensuring they can achieve economic success and stability. So we have predominantly nonprofits in our membership, and a lot of the stories that we hear from our network echo what you've heard from Michael and Brianka earlier in the show. So on their behalf, our work is to translate that into policy recommendations for key stakeholders at the federal and state level and try and see if we can't move the needle on these figures.
Can you give us a sense for what policies exist in Indiana that have an impact on the eviction process?
Yeah.
And
so
those suffering from it?
I think, and Michael touched on this a little bit, and the process itself disadvantages at present, particularly low-income renters who have perpetually hard time keeping up with rental costs or have an eviction on the record previously. So based on the data and the recommendations from, you know, what other states have done, we had looked to work on a couple of bills at the state level to try and revise the landlord-tenant relationship slightly to allow for more balance there. So some of the things that worked on for the first time in 10 years last session, there were two bills introduced related to landlord-tenant habitability issues. And those did not progress, but we think it's part of a larger conversation. And thanks to the data that we have from Eviction Lab, combined with the stories that we have from our member network, we think lawmakers are increasingly taking interest in this and seeking out those solutions. So the fact that people can't withhold rent when there's severe habitability violations over periods of time, we'll have people just get so frustrated living in toxic mold without plumbing, without heating. And that's not, you know, the predominant, I'm not going to say all landlords are bad actors, predominantly wonderful actors. But we have situations where families don't really have a lot of recourse when they're living in poor housing conditions, and that can lead to eviction. So the second that they don't pay their rent, so non-payment of rent, like Michael said, is a very frequent reason people are evicted very quickly. Interestingly, Matt Desmond, who was in town 2 weeks ago, along with Senator Young and a number of our members up in South Bend and in Fort Wayne, noted that the Lyft driver on the way to the event said that he was a big fan of housing in Indiana because in the evictions process, it happened so fast. He had a tenant he evicted in 7 days.
Whoa.
So his Lyft driver on the way over to a housing event actually provided some of that context. Another key issue is the fact that we don't have a uniform notice to quit. So when you're given a 10-day notice, when you're in violation of your lease, to come up with the rent money, largely that's the predominant issue there. That only applies to informal leases. And predominantly leases are written. So it really blunts the ability of tenants to defend themselves and try to come up with a rent payment in time. So I would just point to Bill's Senate Bill 524 that was authored by Senator Melton last session, as well as Senate Bill 422, which was authored by Senator Mike Bohacek, who is a landlord, interestingly, and was kind of surprised by some of the things we brought to his attention. And so those dealt with some serious habitability issues, but also some of that cost burden. So increasing the notice period when there's a rental increase from 30 to 60 days in Senator Melton's bill. Some of those really core issues that speak to the obstacles our members see in their communities.
Robin from Facebook says, as a former Housing Authority employee with the Housing Choice Voucher, which is a Section 8 program, I have to say that tenants with a voucher that get court-ordered eviction automatically lose their voucher and cannot get back on the program for 5 years or more. Utility bills and loss of employment seem to be the big problems. Caseworkers can have resources and phone numbers of helping agencies for those tenants, so don't wait until it's too late. Contact your caseworker, call 211, call trustees or charity organizations before it gets to that point.
And that's really important because when people get vouchers, they're actually one of the lucky few. Only one in four households who qualify for federal housing assistance, like vouchers, receives it. So when you think about somebody losing that ability to supplement their income so they can remain stably housed, that's a huge destabilizing factor for that household.
You've said that you haven't had success with some policies that you've tried to get changed. What are some of the obstacles in your way when you try to get things done?
Well, I think that there's an education gap. So that's part of why Eviction Lab was so important, is that we were able to quantify it in a way that earlier we relied a lot on anecdotal stories from our member networks and housing folks on the ground. So we were able to quantify it. And I think there was a sense that legislators need to hear more about what's happening and to look to other states. So, you know, sometimes the first time a bill is introduced is very rarely does it just fly through. So I think this is a chance for our network and partners who are very concerned about housing stability and the destabilizing effects of that can have a chance to talk to lawmakers about what that means overall. We just were endorsed as the Opportunity Starts at Home State Coalition. That is also a part of this effort to bring in other partners, so multi-sector voices in healthcare, criminal justice reform, domestic violence. All of these voices are affected by housing instability, so we are attempting to broaden the group of folks who are talking about the evictions crisis and the affordable housing crisis here in Indiana through that effort. And so we're very excited about expanding the number of voices who are speaking up about this. And I think that will see long-term gains in moving the needle.
Is it a challenge to get some lawmakers interested? How has their level of interest changed at all in recent years as this sort of grows in interest?
Well, I think I'm hopeful because of the fact the federal level, we have leaders in our state, like Senator Young, who has certainly taken on affordable housing in a pretty broad way. He's introduced a series of bills that we are very excited about. But I think that some of the fact that you see this on a federal level being discussed in ways it has never been discussed before provides us optimism that that's going to trickle down to the state level and that some of this increased data that we have will provide the evidence that they need to be able to take action and look to other states and say, hey, like, are there ways that we can revise? This is an issue of resources, but it's also an issue of process. And what revisions can we make to make sure that this doesn't continue?
Can you talk about unique issues that come up when families are evicted?
Yeah. And so, I mean, just heartbreaking stories that we hear. In fact, at the South Bend event, there was a woman who was speaking about the fact that she was getting evicted currently. And the fact that her and her son, she had no idea where her son would end up going to school. Mm. She had no idea where their next meal was going to come from. You'll hear stories like that. And that's very that's kind of at the root of the Opportunity Starts at Home Coalition, too, is that we have a lot of data about how Indiana is behind in health outcomes, economic mobility outcomes, because we can correlate that to some housing instability. So our maternal mortality rates are exceptionally high. Incidence of asthma, lead poisoning, all of that is related to poor housing quality and housing instability. So when kids are moving multiple times, which is so frequently the case in evictions, their test scores suffer. They're unable to keep up with the stresses that are at home. It bleeds into their performance at school and with their mental health as well.
There doesn't seem to be a typical outcome for a lot of these situations because they're all so specific and unique. But you got into what happens to the children. What ends up happening? What are some examples of what happens to kids after families get evicted?
Well, I think what we've seen, and Michael can probably add to this too because he worked a long time in the homeless services sphere, is that when you have a family that's had housing stability at a young age, that typically continues with the child into adulthood. So it's very difficult to escape that cycle and to get into, because you're typically living in areas where school quality is lower. You're living in areas where you're not able to access some of the resources that other kids are. And you're moving so many times, you're unable to kind of escape this pattern and establish healthy relationships in the community. And so that is, I think, a really common occurrence, is that we've seen kids who grew up with a lot of housing instability and unfortunately seeing that persist.
Have you seen those outcomes, Michael?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of data on that. There was a study that came out a number of years ago called ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And one of the factors for adults experiencing trauma or experiencing poverty or experiencing a number of the parade of horribles would be trauma that they experienced as a child, and some of those traumas are the housing instability, housing insecurity that they experienced. You know, when I was working with trauma victims, one of the things that we would experience with kids coming in for counseling, for whatever it might be for, was that they expected bad things to happen to them. They talked about when I'm murdered or when this other terrible thing happens to me, then this is going to happen. Not if. I mean, it was a fait accompli. It was going to happen at some point in the time. I just wanted to also piggyback on something that both Kathleen and Bianca talked about, and it's the irony or the catch-22 that we have, especially with serial evictions. When just the mere filing of the case will have an adverse impact on that tenant's ability to get financial assistance or to find affordable housing moving forward, even if they're not evicted in that case. Because what's going to happen is if an action is filed against a tenant for nonpayment of rent and the tenant is able to subsequently pay it, even after the leverage of a possession order and a writ of eviction is entered, they get to stay. But that writ of eviction and that possession order are still part of the permanent public court record. And so when they apply for other housing moving forward, that's what future landlords are going to see. A case was filed, there was a possession order, there was a writ entered, and it's really not going to matter that they got to stay because they ended up paying because they had that case filed against them. And one more thing about that. In Marion County, with all 9 townships in Marion County, once an action is filed by a landlord to collect rent, any financial assistance that tenant might have been able to get from, say, the trustee's office is going to be foreclosed now because there's a pending case. The trustee's not going to give them the rent that they need to stay in the housing because there's a case that's pending against them, and they can't find other housing to move to because there's a case pending against them. Mm-hmm. So even if they're acting in good faith and trying to fix things, they're stuck by the fact that there's a case pending.
And that's really important to note, because a lot of what our housing networks will say is we have an issue of people having enough money to afford housing costs. And then we also have shelters continually filled with people who have evictions on their record because it's a scarlet letter on their record. They are unable to find landlords who are willing to take them, even if they've been able to manage the high security deposits.
Right.
They've been able to cobble together enough resources to get back on their feet. That is such a huge barrier.
Yeah, I think a landlord, even a very reasonable landlord, is going to look at somebody who's had cases filed against them or who has evictions on their record, and they're going to require a double security deposit, or they're going to have a premium on the monthly rent. So that individual who already was having a hard time affording housing as a result of the eviction or just a result of the case being filed against them is now going to have to pay a higher premium to rent housing that is less affordable now and that might not even be as secure. They might have to go to housing that's not as secure or not as safe because the landlord that's willing to take a chance on them is a landlord that may not be charging them the fair market rate or that may not be keeping the place up.
One eviction snowballs into a massive, significant problem.
It really does, man.
Back to affordable housing. How does that fit into this and how does your advocacy work, Kathleen?
So we work across the federal and state level about the need for affordable housing. Indiana, I think, is widely considered a very affordable place to live by most measures, especially nationally. But that's certainly a matter of perspective. We have 46% of our renters who are cost burdened, paying more than 30% of their income towards housing costs. We also have 212,000 households that are earning 30% of median income. And that, just for perspective, that's about $21,000 a year for a family of four. And so we have housing that's out of reach for a lot of Hoosiers. And we release a report that can break that down by community on our website. But it means that if you're working minimum wage, in order to afford a two-bedroom apartment, you have to work 88 hours a week. That's a state average. And what you'll find is, surprisingly, that's not just in markets you'd consider expensive, but a pretty stable average from county to county. And so what we think is that we need to have a multifaceted, comprehensive approach. We have to expand the resources to preserve and expand the supply of affordable housing, especially for those who are earning that low, extremely low income level. And then we have to address some of the policy barriers, like we mentioned with renter protections. And then the nonprofits within our membership that are working really hard to expand that development, looking at some of the zoning issues and some of the land use restrictions that are kind of preventing affordable housing from coming in. Those are all part of our conversation. And certainly there's going to be a lot of discussion about the budget now that Congress has come to a deal about the caps. So when they reconvene back in September, the Senate's going to be considering legislation. Will be very active at the federal level on appropriations to ensure that we can expand those resources, because the fact that only one in four households that qualifies for housing assistance gets it is directly correlated to the affordable housing crisis we see play out on the ground, people paying far too much on their rent to be stably housed. And so that's part of what we do. We've also got, this is not a budget session, but some longer term goals is to address some tax credit resources that would expand affordable housing at the state level. So we think there's solutions at a lot of levels. A lot of them are resources. Some of them are tools. How can we direct federal housing assistance, for instance, to people experiencing economic shocks like job loss, a medical incident, so that we can help avert some evictions in the first place. There's some federal legislation that just is rolling out on that. So those are the things that we're looking at and speaking up in support of.
Got about less than a minute left. What is the Opportunity Starts at Home Indiana Coalition?
Yeah, so that is the multi-sector campaign. Matt Desmond called for a coalition of unusual suspects and a need to expand resources for affordable housing and address evictions. And that's what I would call this. It is aimed at bringing in voices from the health sector, from the criminal justice movement, and other sectors that are not traditionally engaged in affordable housing advocacy to speak up, because the issues are so correlated. They are interdependent. We see health, education, economic mobility outcomes all relating to somebody's stable, safe housing. So it is our effort. There's information on our website, prosperityindiana.org. We encourage people to come there. It's under programs.
All right. I want to thank you all so much for your perspectives. Kathleen Lara, Policy Director for Prosperity Indiana. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Michael Hurst, Senior Attorney at Indiana Legal Services. Thanks for hanging around.
Thanks for having me.
Remember, you can sign up for topic alerts at WFYI.org/all-in so you always know what we'll be talking about the morning of the show. And here's one for you. Next time, we'll be talking about the vibrant culture of youth sports in Indiana. Everything from local t-ball to interstate travel soccer. What benefits have you or your children gotten from being involved in sports? Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.